From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. We're proud to present a live concert on today's Fresh Air with the musician jazz critic Whitney Balliot, called the hardest swinging jazz pianist of all time, Dave McKenna. Also today, we meet Fresh Air jazz critic Kevin Whitehead in another installment in our series of interviews with Fresh Air's contributors. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new comedy Working Girl, and rock critic Ken Tucker reviews three new movie soundtrack albums that offer more than just background music. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Today we have a live concert with the jazz pianist that many agree is the best there is when it comes to interpreting songs, Dave McKenna. Jazz critic Dan Morgenstern writes that McKenna's singular artistry covers the whole vocabulary of piano, from stride to bop. New Yorker jazz critic Whitney Balliot called Dave McKenna the hardest swinging jazz pianist of all time. But Balliot pointed out this paradox, quote, McKenna plays the piano with supreme authority, but considers himself a barroom pianist, unquote. For the past 9 years, McKenna has performed nightly at an elegantly appointed bar in Boston's Copley Plaza Hotel. Summers he performs on Cape Cod. He has close to a dozen recent solo and small group albums on the Concord Jazz record label, and CBS Records just reissued a session of his from the late 1950s. If you're a regular listener to Fresh Air, you've heard excerpts from many of McKenna's records between segments on our show. And I have to tell you that this is a concert we've been hoping to present for a long time. Dave McKenna, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a complete pleasure to have you here.
Thanks, Terry.
And I'd like to ask you to introduce the first song you'd like to play.
Okay, this is a tune by Dietzen Schwartz called By Myself.
That's beautiful. You know, I especially like hearing you perform solo. And I think the reason is that your sense of rhythm is so strong. It's like you're accompanying yourself. And I just assumed not hear anybody with you so I can hear completely what it is you're doing, and I was wondering if you especially like playing solo.
Well, of course, it's the way I make my living now. But it's fun to play with a band. I don't... the bass-piano duo thing or the piano-trio thing doesn't work with me because it's that in-between thing. I don't think I ever got that down. But I really love playing with bass and drums and a horn or two, you know, trumpet and saxophone and a guitar, too. I love that. But I play a different way then, and it's just... It really is fun. But anything less than four pieces, I'd rather be alone, I think, because I can... It's great working with good bass players, and there are plenty of them now, and drummers, but this way I can change tempo. I'd have to work with a bass player for years and just change tunes, you know, and when you play solo, a lot of it is just killing time, killing the clock.
You think so?
Yeah.
Oh, one more question before we get to the next song. That was just called By Myself, what you just played. And uh-huh. I think of you as having gone by yourself in a way of being a bit of a loner, playing, you know, for long stays in a supper club or in a hotel and having lots of people come to you, and you have a home base, which is something very few people in jazz have the luxury of.
Yeah, I've really been lucky that way. I avoided a lot of traveling, although I like to do a certain amount. I still get on the road some. And maybe we'll get on the road considerably more soon. I don't know.
Would you play another song for us?
Sure.
Was Yours Is My Heart Alone, performed live by pianist Dave McKenna. When you're playing a song, do you usually know the lyrics to it?
Well, I didn't used to know. I don't think I know the words to one song all the way through. But You know, I do like to listen to singers, and bits and pieces of the words come back to me. And it's nice when you know a few. I think it
does
really
it help
makes
with
you,
the interpretation?
I think so. I think it helps helps you to play the melody better.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I do remember a few of the words now. Never used to.
Do you like to learn a song from just hearing it or from sheet music?
I'm such a I'm a bad sight reader. I just rather hear it, yeah, from somebody. That the trouble is now that to hear a song, I don't learn many new songs, to tell you the truth, because there are a lot of good rock songs and there are a few top 40 things, but they need guitars or singers or something. There aren't many tunes that really sound good on the piano that are being written now. But I suppose there are a few, and once in a while, somebody asks me to learn something, so I get the sheet music. But even then, I'd rather hear somebody play it or sing it before I play it.
I'm going to ask you to play another song. You want to do Sweet Lorraine?
Yeah.
Performed for us live by Dave McKenna. You know, I want to ask you, I know that for the past 9 years or so, you've been at the Copley in a very elegant bar there. A lot of times when people go into a bar, they're pleased that there's music, but they don't necessarily know the first thing about music or the first thing about what they're hearing, and they might talk while the musician is playing. How does that affect you when people are talking and you're playing?
That's cool. It's such a comfortable situation. The Copley Most people who come into Rome aren't coming in to hear me because a lot of them are convention people or from the hotel. And they're just in for a drink in nice surroundings. And so it's not a concert, and I don't expect to. In many cases, it's easier playing because I can, you know, I just play lightly and fiddle around and play. If you think of what I'm going to play next, there's no pressure. I could play quietly a good part of the night, and I usually come up a little bit in volume at the end of a set to let them know I'm near, that I've been working. And some nights people listen, and a lot of times they don't, but essentially it's a background music gig, really, and I'm happy with it. I mean, I've been happy with it, and I had 9 years or so, and I like staying in Boston. It was a nice stay at the hotel. It's walking distance from brought anything in town, including the ballpark, and everything's handy in that city. You know,
I saw you perform once at a club in Cape Cod, and the room was filled. You were staring off into space, not intentionally, I thought, not making eye contact with anybody. You know, just focused on nothing in particular, but obviously very very focused, but really avoiding people.
Was that
eyes.
The Capitol and L House?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was a fun. That's a nice place, and for years, the family, great friends of mine, they're wonderful people, the Lumens that ran it. But that gig, people did listen a lot there.
Oh, yeah, no, it was like a
concert. And,
but
it
seemed to
times,
me you just didn't want to see anybody.
Some nights were noisy. Well, yeah, when
you're
playing in those circumstances and everybody's listening, how to say, I'm saying to myself, oh, gee, how am I going to fill up an hour if these people are listening intently? So when I'm looking over into space, I'm thinking of medleys to play, things that'll wind the clock down, you know? I really am.
Well, I don't fully understand, yeah.
Getting things together to play. You know?
Uh-huh. It amazes me that you're worried about people listening intently.
Well, no, I'm not worried about it. If they want to, I'll play. But you have to work harder then.
Right, I see. Okay. All right. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll continue the concert. My guest is one of the very great jazz pianists, Dave McKenna, who's based in Boston and Cape Cod and is joining us for a live concert today. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is pianist Dave McKenna, and his latest album on the Concord Jazz label is called My Friend the Piano. And he also has a recently reissued album on CBS Records of a session back from the late 1950s. Well, why don't we get back to the concert? Let's see, I think next you're going to play Sea Jam Blues.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Oh, great. Do you plan out what you're going to play at all before you play it? Plan out, I mean the improvisation, but just the tempo you're going to play at, what your basic concept for a song or a piece is going to be.
Well, really kind of vaguely, because I didn't really know what tempo I was going to play that. But that change of key, I did that on record, changing the keys, because I thought maybe a feeble attempt to be clever. If it's C Jan, it means the key. And so I changed it to E flat for one 12-bar chorus and one to G flat or F sharp, whatever that is, and one in A, up in minor thirds, and ending back in C. So that was a little game. So I do use that whenever I play that, a little change of key at the end.
You know, sitting right next to you at the piano, I'm really watching your hands carefully, and you have such a strong left hand when I hear your records. And your left hand is almost gently approaching the keyboard. I mean, you don't seem to be exerting yourself with your left hand at all.
I try to work hard. I'm not really adept. I can play, if I play it with some strength, then it gets kind of sloppy. I came to stride piano late. I only use it for a few bars at a time, but that's real work. I stand in awe of those guys that play it all the time, you know. Ralph Sutton, Dick Wellstone.
Yeah.
They really play it hard and accurately, you know. And
is accurate hard when you're playing stride?
Yeah, I think so. Because they've been playing it a long time. You know, some guys made a specialty of it, and their whole career was based on that. You know, the older guys, Fats and James P., those are the guys that invented it, I guess. But as far as the walking bass, that sort of just playing bass notes, that just seemed to come naturally to me, and it's not much exertion required there.
Were you self-taught, or was there a pianist who
studied
carefully with?
I had lessons from... My first teachers were the nuns and parochials. My mother's a real good musician, though. She played piano and violin, but she didn't want to teach, so she sent me the nuns. And I didn't really like to practice, but I could always pick tunes out that I heard on the radio and always played by ear, it seems, since I was about 7 years old. So I had a couple of good teachers, a guy in Boston, Sandy Sandiford, who was a jazz musician of sorts. I mean, he was a good jazz player, but he made his living writing showbiz charts for the singers around Boston. But he didn't, I was 16 or so by the time I went to him, and he didn't really fool with the way I played. He just made a few suggestions into how to organize it. And he said, why don't you make a little arrangement of this? And the lessons were kind of spotty because I was still living in my parents' house, and I didn't get up there often. But he had some nice suggestions anyway.
We're going to have time for one more song, and can I make a request?
Yeah.
Would you play Thanks for the Memory?
Of course. Thank you.
That was great. Do you have a good musical memory? Do you know lots and lots and lots of songs?
I think I knew quite a few. I'm not one of the champions, though. Guys like Jimmy Rolls, I don't know how many, Men of a Thousand Tunes. But I knew quite a few, and it doesn't seem, though, as if I've been adding to the repertoire lately. I don't learn too many new songs. But a lot of the tunes I've been playing, I think I've known since I was 12 years old. That's not one of them, though. I never realized I liked the tune until, I don't know, I heard somebody do it, and that's one I came upon fairly late. Although I'd heard of it, you know, being a Bob Hope theme and all.
I want to thank you so very much for joining us for this concert. It's really been a pleasure to have you here. And I want to say you've helped me hear a lot of songs in fresh ways through your interpretations of them. So thank you. Thank you very much for all your playing and for doing the concert today.
Thank you, Terry. I enjoyed it.
And my guest has been pianist Dave McKenna. And if you want to hear more of his playing, he has about 11 records on the Concord Jazz record label. His latest is My Friend the Piano. And also CBS Records has just reissued a session of his from the late 50s. And he's the resident pianist at Boston's Copley Plaza Hotel. So that's some of the ways you can hear his playing. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, it's our big end-of-the-year rock and roll countdown show with rock critic Ken Tucker, and he'll do his best records of 1988, and we'll play them. You'll get a chance to hear them. So that's all coming up on the next Fresh Air. I hope you can join us. Dave McKenna, I want to wish you a very happy new year, and I'd like to ask you if you would play us out with some Auld Lang Syne.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Kevin Whitehead spent a few years in the seminary, studied literature in college, and discovered jazz because of Captain Beefheart. Coming up, we find out how Fresh Air's jazz critic ended up listening to music for a living. It's the latest in our series of interviews with Fresh Air's contributors. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews three new soundtrack albums that are worth a listen, even if you miss the movies. And film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of the new comedy Working Girl, starring Melanie Griffith. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. Key congressional leaders have expressed approval of a federal commission's recommendation to close 86 U.S. military bases to cut back on waste and defense spending. In all, 145 bases would be closed, partially closed, or reorganized. Senate Armed Services Committee Chairman Sam Nunn called the report a step forward, but he said he would like to have seen more. The changes would save less than $700 million a year. The Pentagon spends $300 billion a year. Nunn said he thinks the panel's recommendations will be approved by Congress, which faces an all-or-nothing decision on the plan. Thousands of jobs may be lost as a result of the proposals, and reaction in and around the affected bases generally has been negative. In New Jersey, Fort Dix would be downgraded to semi-active status. Gene Dillard has more.
Both New Jersey Governor Tom Kaine and Congressman James Saxton expressed shock at the news about Fort Dix and pledged to fight the recommendation. Although the commission's report says the cutback should have only a moderate impact on local employment, owners of area restaurants, taverns, and dry cleaners used words like devastated, dejected, and sad to describe their feelings. Marcel Nissim has owned Wrightstown Liquors just off the military base for 38 years. If Dix is scaled back, he says the impact on his business would be disastrous.
It would really create a tremendous drop because most of my business are from the military. Percentage-wise, I would say approximately 80-85% of the military come shop in my store, and I depend upon them.
Civilian workers at the base express concern about their jobs, too. But some said they're not going to worry yet, since previous threats of cutbacks at Dix have turned out to be false alarms. For National Public Radio, I'm Gene Dillard in Wrightstown, New Jersey.
The Federal Aviation Administration announced today some stringent new security requirements for U.S. airlines at airports in the Middle East and Western Europe. The FAA is ordering that all luggage be X-rayed or physically inspected and that carry-on bags be subjected to random physical searches. The new measures were announced today after British authorities said it was a bomb that caused the crash last week of Pan Am Flight 103 in Lockerbie, Scotland. President-elect Bush pledged today to deal firmly with those responsible for what he called a cowardly bombing.
Seek hard and punish firmly, decisively those who did this, if you can ever find them. Most imprudent thing a responsible official could do is to discuss what kind of action would be taken or would not be taken.
The State Department said today it is working under the belief that the bomb was the work of terrorists and not an individual criminal act. Armenian officials now say the death toll from the recent earthquake may be much lower than earlier estimates. One of the Soviet Republic's deputy prime ministers says that so far nearly 25,000 bodies have been recovered. The official death toll previously had been more than twice as high. By yesterday, about 15,000 people had been saved from the rubble. It could cost as much as $14 billion to repair the damage done by the quake. The Kremlin has ordered the names of disgraced leaders Leonid Brezhnev and Konstantin Chernenko wiped off their former homes, as well as from every town, school, and factory christened for them. The TASS news agency announced the decree, which is seen as a further blow against the 18-year legacy of Brezhnev and is viewed as an expansion of Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev's campaign against the corruption and stagnation of his predecessor's year in power. Japanese Prime Minister Noboru Takeshita has accepted the resignation of the country's newly appointed justice minister. Reports from Japan say Takashi Hasegawa stepped down late today amid a storm of criticism over accepting political donations from a company at the center of a stock profiteering scandal. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Nowadays, there's not much of a correlation between the box office receipts from a film and the sales of its soundtrack album. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of three current soundtracks, each of which he says contains some pretty interesting music. Here, for example, is the title cut from the soundtrack album from the movie Twins.
The presence of rock music in movies is now taken for granted. Even more than that, placing rock songs in a movie has become an essential way of selling both the music and the film to consumers. Billboard magazine pointed out in its year-end issue that three soundtrack albums, Cocktail, Dirty Dancing, and More Dirty Dancing, spent more time at number one than any other records in 1988. A new batch of soundtrack albums has just been released. They haven't been around long enough to prove their commercial success or failure yet, but three of them contain interesting music that can stand apart from its presence in the movie theater. The current hit movie Twins stars Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito. There's a big, glossy title tune for this movie that pairs another odd couple, Little Richard and Philip Bailey, formerly of Earth, Wind, and Fire. There are songs by performers ranging from Bobby McFerrin to Jeff Beck, but the best piece of music is performed by a group familiar only to hardcore rap fans, the 2 Live Crew. They weigh in with a very clever remake of the old Coasters hit, Yakety Yak.
Behind your dad's back, you roll your eyes. Going splat and scheming and planning lies. But you're always doing things to make it mad instead of doing right for good old dad. So tell your friends you're not hanging out. Just do as I say, cause I'm the man of the house. You better act like you got some sense, man.
Don't you give me no dirty look.
The 2 Live Crew from the soundtrack to Twins. In contrast to that album, which uses the old Saturday Night Fever strategy of featuring a slew of different performers, the soundtrack to the new film Beaches features only its star, Bette Midler. The surprise is that this is nothing less than Bette Midler's best album since her 1971 debut, The Divine Miss M. Midler has always been one of the mysteries of the music business. How can so talented and intelligent a performer have made so many bad records? Midler's earlier albums were eclectic to a fault, aimless in their confusing variety of styles. Beaches is another potpourri of pop, but this time around, it works.
From the park you hear happy sounds from the carousel. You can almost taste the hot dogs and french fries they sell. Under the football, down by the sea. On a blanket.
One reason I think this album is so strong is that Bette Midler is singing in character. In Beaches, she plays a blowsy, aggressive would-be star, and that's the way she approaches each song here. The result is a more unified style than Midler has demonstrated in the past, whether she's singing the rock oldie I just played, Under the Boardwalk, or a gentler song such as I Think It's Going to Rain Today. This Randy Newman composition has been recorded by everyone from Judy Collins to Peggy Lee, and it's usually been sung as a baleful dirge. Midler's interpretation, however, is less despairing and more matter-of-fact. She denies the melodrama built into the lyric and, as a result, makes the song more moving.
Lonely, so lonely. Sinking at my feet, I think I'll kick it down the street. The way to treat a friend. Right before me, the signs implore me. Help the needy and show them the way. Human kindness is overflowing. And I think it's gone.
Finally, there's the soundtrack album to a film now in limited release called I'm Gonna Get You, Sucka. That's not me trying to get funky. That last word is spelled S-U-C-K-A. The movie is a spoof of those black exploitation films of the early 70s like Superfly and The Mac. Writing a soundtrack to even a parody of this genre must have been intimidating, since this area of filmmaking has yielded such wonderful music as Curtis Mayfield's score to Superfly and Marvin Gaye's work on Trouble Man. The Gap Band wrote and performed the title song of this new film, and they've come up with a song that is both amusing and honorable to its tradition.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Whether or not you know you are the obstruction, it don't take no Einstein to figure out that. Well, you've been peeping and hiding, slipping and sliding, living in vain, selling that crap, and that's a natural fact. Well, I'm gonna get your sucker, dirty mother.
Don't you say that.
I'm gonna teach you the crime, just don't pay. I'm gonna get your sucker.
This is Fresh Air. Each week on Fresh Air, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album. Today we're going to find out more about Kevin in another installment in our series of interviews with Fresh Air contributors. Besides writing about jazz for various magazines and newspapers, Kevin has been a restaurant reviewer and movie critic. But I wanted to know how he first got interested in jazz.
I get into it in a way, I guess, which is not totally uncommon. I started out, like most people of my generation, as a listener to rock and roll. And then I stumbled on the music of Captain Beefheart, who I guess you'd say plays crunching avant-garde rock and roll. And after I started listening to Beefheart for a while, all rock sounded tame to me. And I started looking around for something else that sort of had the same punch. And that's when I discovered the free improvised music, the free jazz of the late 60s and early 70s. Got into that to a great extent and then started working backwards from there.
Did you have a friend who listened to a lot of jazz who suggested records to listen to or records to buy? Did you do a lot of hit-and-miss record shopping yourself when you were starting out?
More of the latter. One thing that I've noticed when I talk to a lot of musicians who are in their 30s now, I don't know if it's typical of other people, that most of our early exposure to jazz depended on the records that were in the $1.99 bins at the local record store. I mean,
right.
Those are the only things we could afford. We really didn't know what we were looking for. So for whatever reason, you know, I mean, there was, at the time, in the mid-70s, when I got into it heavily for the first time, there was a wide range of music that was available in the bins. You know, and looking back on it now, I know that it was sort of reprehensible in a way because the artists don't make any royalty profits off those. But for people without a lot of money, it's sort of necessary.
How did you start writing jazz criticism?
I guess when I was at Syracuse, I took a jazz history course. And after the professor got up to about 1950, I realized that I knew more about the subject than he did. And then I started reading some jazz magazines, and I would read some reviews of records that I was pretty familiar with and thought that I could sort of do a better job or at least had a different perspective to bring to it. So I started writing for Cadence, which is a small magazine, but which is receptive to new writers. In fact, one of the reasons that I still write for them is that I'm really grateful to them for giving me that opportunity.
You've praised a lot of regional musicians on Fresh Air and sounded really grateful that there are a lot of musicians working in atmospheres outside of, far from New York. And I think, in a way, you're the counterpart of those musicians because you're living in Baltimore. It's not that far from New York, but you're not in the capital of the jazz world. And you're also not writing for the New York press, which is the press that a lot of the musicians and a lot of the jazz critics read on a daily or weekly basis.
I'd say that's probably part of the influence of Bob Roush, the editor at Cadence, who's always been a big believer in the idea that there was a lot of good music that was happening that wasn't from New York. I was born in New York City. I was born in Brooklyn. Grew up in suburban New Jersey and on Long Island. But after I got away from there, I guess I'd sort of developed this attitude that I didn't really care for the way that people from New York acted as if everything in the world happened there. And since there are so many critics who are centered in New York and primarily writing about music in New York, I guess I see it as sort of a counterbalancing tendency on my own part.
Mm-hmm. Is it good for a critic to be able to go to a lot of concerts as well as listen to the records of musicians?
Yeah, certainly. Records don't always give an accurate indication of where a musician is at any given time. There are a lot of commercial factors that come into play in the recording studio that don't come into play live. And also, sometimes you'll hear a kind of adventurousness in someone's playing in a live situation that you'll notice is missing on a record, whereas if you'd only heard them on record, you might not have even known that they were that a musician was capable of this particular kind of way of expressing themselves.
Now, we here at Fresh Air know you as a jazz critic. You're also a musician, and since, I think, 1974, you've played with a group of musicians and a band called Starship Beer.
That's right.
It's something that you describe as nut music.
Nut music, yeah. It's free improvised music, but I don't see it as jazz. I mean, it really... It comes more out of a garage rock band tendency. It's something actually I'm pretty uncritical about. I mean, we produced a record of our own about 10 years ago, and when the few reviews that we got came out, you know, I grumbled that we were geniuses who were unacknowledged the way many musicians do. I mean, it gave me a perspective on how musicians feel about criticism, but it also made me realize that this was just something that I wanted to do for pleasure, and it really didn't matter what people were going to say about it.
And how did you learn to play?
Let me see. When I started playing the guitar, which was my first instrument, I bought a book called Learn to Play Like the Monkeys, which I think probably should have been called Learn to Play Like the Monkeys Learn to Play. And I got some chord charts there and figured out where the notes were on the guitar neck. And from there to the bass, it's an easy transition. I also play the upright bass poorly. Actually, I play a lot of instruments poorly. I mean, I have like an arsenal of instruments at home. I have like an alto saxophone and a bass clarinet and a variety of other things. I can't really play most of them that well, but it gives me a sense of what's possible, what's obvious and what's not obvious on an instrument. I mean, that's given me some good insights into the work of musicians who sort of fight the natural tendency of an instrument or give into it in some kind of constructive way.
Well, I want to hear how the group sounds, the group you play in, Starship Beer. So you've brought in a cassette of your band, and you've queued it up to a point. Tell us what we're about to hear.
Oh, this is a piece called Jujuka Formica. It's for me and one of the guys in Starship Beer, Pat O'Brien. We're both playing keyboards, and Pat is playing synthetic percussion.
Okay, let's give it a listen.
Really swings, eh?
Which keyboard was you?
Oh, I was playing the sampler that sounded like a little nya-nya voice. That was actually a sample of our guitarist, Wes Minchin's work. Wes had to go teach school that day, so he couldn't be in on the session.
I like it. Does it go on like that? I mean, does it...
How long does it go on like that?
For quite
a while. Oh, I don't know, 10 minutes or more, I suppose, you know.
I remember somebody once saying, and this was a musician, that free music is a lot more fun to play than to listen to.
It certainly is fun to play. I mean, obviously I find it fun to listen to because it was one of the things that attracted me to jazz in the first place. Actually, a lot of times, well, like I was just at the New Music America Festival in Miami a couple of weeks ago, and to me, a lot of the most interesting music that I heard was the free improvised music because there's just this sense of danger. You know, when people start playing and they really don't know where they're going. But at the same time, there's sort of there's a set of organizing principles that kind of crop up when people are playing free. So it's not that there's no style, as some people maintain, but that it is actually a style of its own.
In preparation for this interview, we asked you to send us a little bit of more background and about you. And I learned some things that really surprised me about you. Probably the most surprising thing is that you went to a seminary
before college. Yeah, that's true. I spent 4 years in high school trying to decide whether I wanted to be a Catholic priest or not. And
did you feel that you were called?
For a while, I don't know. I don't know how to say whether I felt I had a calling or not. I mean, it's been a while. It's funny, though. I read there was a book that came out a couple of years ago called Jazz, Myth, and Religion by Neil Leonard. And a really ingenious book in which he examines how the rise and spread of jazz kind of mirrored the rise and spread of any religious movement. Uh-huh. And in his scheme of things, critics had the role of priests, interpreting and misinterpreting the works of the saints and martyrs. So... maybe there was something lingering in the back of my mind there.
I was wondering if critical thinking was encouraged or discouraged while you were in the seminary.
I would say it was encouraged. In fact, I'm really grateful to one teacher in particular that I had in high school who kind of pointed me toward the idea of being a writer. It was something that I really hadn't considered before that.
Was it hard for you when you first started writing to earn a living as a freelancer? And I should say here that the jazz press is notoriously low-paying.
Yeah, it was a little slow for a few years. I mean, I was sort of... in a sense, I never stopped living like a student, you know, and that was sort of an advantage because I never... It never seemed unreasonable to me that I wasn't making at least $20,000 a year. And, I don't mean, it doesn't pay well, but I get to work at home. When you work for yourself, you have a reasonably understanding boss. You know, I don't have to put on a tie in the morning. It's about 20 feet from my bed to the office. You know, I get to listen to the music. I mean, for a living, to me, that's an incredible privilege.
Okay. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Fresh Air jazz critic Kevin Whitehead. Here's Kevin and his band Starship Beer with their rendition of Last Train to Clarksville. This is Fresh Air. Alex Chadwick is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of what's coming up on All Things Considered. Alex, what story are you following?
Terry, you know there's been this bipartisan commission studying what military bases around the country might be closed or shut down or altered in some way in order to save money in the defense budget. Well, the report is out today. It's much more sweeping than anyone had expected. They recommend 86 base closings and the sort of semi-closings of even more bases. So we'll have that story. A reaction from San Francisco, where among the bases recommended for closing is the Presidio Army base there. And from New Hampshire, this commission has recommended closing the Pease Air Force Base, which is in New Hampshire. That coming up, Terry.
Thanks, Alex. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. How high can you climb in corporate America when you're wearing spike heels and tight miniskirts? This question is addressed in the new comedy Working Girl. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
To judge from the movies, you'd think there was only one story to tell about corporate America. Let's see now. The innocent arrives in New York with little training but plenty of native savvy. Doors are slammed in his face, whereupon by some extraordinary act of dishonesty and imposture, he tricks the world into believing he's a fast-track executive. Then, with the help of a wise and godlike CEO, he topples the villain, usually another executive who, arch-fiend that he is, has worked his way up by learning the ropes, getting his degree, and toiling till the wee hours. This, more or less, is the plot of Working Girl, just as it was, more or less, the plot of The Secret of My Success, and Wall Street, and Big, and, once upon a time, Cinderella. And though Working Girl is fluid and swift and moderately entertaining, its familiarity breeds indifference, if not contempt. The innocent here is Melanie Griffith, as a Staten Island secretary named Tess. The wicked stepsister is her boss, Catherine, an MBA hotshot played with vicious glee by Sigourney Weaver. Weaver's Catherine pays lip service to sisterhood, but is plainly out for number one. For her, even romance is just a variation on mergers and acquisitions.
Perfect. Everything's in place.
For what?
A man I've been seeing for a while. I think he's it. And I think this could be the weekend we decide. He said there was something very important he wanted to discuss with me. I think he's gonna pop the question.
You do?
I think so. We're in the same city now. I've indicated that I'm receptive to an offer. I've cleared the month of June, and I am, after all, me.
Well, what if he doesn't pop the question?
I really don't think that's a variable.
While her boss is laid up with a skiing injury, Tess discovers that Catherine has been secretly pursuing one of Tess's merger ideas, has, in short, been maneuvering behind her back. So Tess decides that in Catherine's absence, she'll pursue the idea herself, posing as an executive and using Catherine's contact in another firm, Jack Traynor, played by Harrison Ford, to close the deal before Catherine can get back. All of which is charming in its trite little way, but enormously unlikely. In the first place, why would an executive like Catherine maneuver behind her secretary's back? Is she planning to do her own Xeroxing as the deal goes through? And for that matter, while Tess is pushing her deal toward the finish line, who's handling the enormous number of documents involved in any real merger? Who's dealing with the lawyers and the accountants and the bankers? Besides, where except on a movie screen does a corporate executive feel threatened by her working-class secretary? All of this may sound picky, but just once I'd like to see a business movie that in some remote way reflected planet Earth. Most of Working Girl's research seems to have gone into the question of dressing for success. And for a while, the director, Mike Nichols, gets a lot of comic mileage out of it. Tess soon discovers that on the ladder to the executive suite, there are rungs where you have to stop and rethink your jewelry. And Melanie Griffith does all this marvelously. Her plushness and quietude and that cotton candy voice make her the most tantalizing of underdogs. In fact, that teensy voice has the same function here that a white hat has in a Western. In a movie whose message seems to be that little insecure sharks are somehow better than big confident ones, that voice is almost all there is to remind us that Tess is the good guy.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, film critic Stephen Schiff presents his picks for the 10 best and 10 worst films of 1988. Also, pianist Mac Rebenack returns in our weekly performance spot, and poet Mark Halliday reads one of his works for us, a poem inspired by a 50s doo-wop group. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Salat, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty, Lisa Bruton, and Becky Thorne. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman and Richard Parker. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.